Scottish Qualifications Authority. National Qualifications 2010. English for Speakers of Other Languages, Higher. Section A, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the following radio discussion. Answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 1, before you hear the recording.
Good morning, and welcome to our weekly programme about the natural world and the environment. Soon it will be time to go mushing again. Mushroom hunting is the quintessential autumn pastime. There's nothing like picking mushrooms to get in touch with the natural world. Unlike most foods, though, there's no commercial alternative to hand-picking mushrooms from the wild. You can't grow seps or chanterelles in your garden. Their subtle ecological needs are impossible to replicate outside their natural habitat. And that, some say, is the trouble. And just how acceptable is all this foraging? Are there any restrictions? Here with me now is botanist Sandra Hill from Scottish Natural Heritage, or SNH. Sandra, first of all, is there such a thing as a national policy on mushroom picking?
Hello, James. The nearest thing we have at the moment to a national policy in Scotland is the Code of Conduct published by SNH. It encourages people to follow 9 simple rules of responsible behaviour to protect themselves from poisonous species, but also allow mushrooms and all that thrive in them to flourish undisturbed.
Does mushroom picking do much harm to the environment?
Wildlife needs mushrooms, so you should only pick what you will use. What people often don't realise is that mushrooms and other fungi are fundamental to the existence of trees and plants. The danger is that too many gatherers may trample an area. You see, the main part of the mushroom is below the surface, and trampling collapses the air spaces in the soil and destroys the underground fungal cells.
So, does commercial picking pose a danger?
I'd say it's fine to collect for the family pot, but we're seeing more and more commercial picking, and there may be too many pickers trampling one site. This is frowned upon.
Thank you, Sandra. Well, frowning is one thing. Prosecuting someone is another. In the 1990s, the Forestry Commission in England banned commercial picking in the New Forest. This brought it into conflict with Barbara Ray, who runs a small business collecting mushrooms there. It ended up in a court battle. We should have Barbara on the line right now. Hello, Barbara.
Good morning, James.
Can you tell us about this experience?
As far as I'm concerned, mushrooms are public property and anyone has the right to pick them. I live near the New Forest and I've been running a small business collecting mushrooms there for 30 years. I sell them to hotels and restaurants.
The Forestry Commission took a different view and prosecuted you for theft, did they not? During the court hearing, they argued that taking products from the forest for commercial gain was like stealing apples from someone's garden.
It was absurd. At least the judge was sensible. He dismissed the case on grounds of pettiness.
So it wasn't seen as a matter for the criminal courts?
Absolutely not. The judge thought it was a waste of time and money. He said he was there to try muggers and drug dealers, not ladies who pick mushrooms.
But shouldn't there be a legal way of challenging commercial pickers if they damage our mushrooms' natural habitat?
Mushrooms actually benefit from careful picking, and commercial pickers usually know what they're doing. When I pick mushrooms, I make sure I don't damage their root system. and I can get a new crop every 10 days for up to 3 months. It's certainly not in my interest to damage the site.
But there have been problems with other commercial pickers who take less care.
Well, when problems arise, it's not from careful mushroom picking by people like me, but from felling trees and damaging the delicate upper layers of the soil where the mushrooms live. Wherever the Forestry Commission has cut down the trees, we won't be seeing the mushrooms again for a long time.
Sandra, a final comment?
It's difficult to say whether there's damage or not. What we are seeing, though, is a massive depletion of the countryside by commercial pickers.
So there we are. Commercial picking may or may not harm the fungus, but no one objects to mushrooms being picked for the kitchen. Good morning, and welcome to our weekly programme about the natural world and the environment. Soon it will be time to go mushing again. Mushroom hunting is the quintessential autumn pastime. There's nothing like picking mushrooms to get in touch with the natural world. Unlike most foods, though, there's no commercial alternative to hand-picking mushrooms from the wild. You can't grow seps or chanterelles in your garden. Their subtle ecological needs are impossible to replicate outside their natural habitat. And that, some say, is the trouble. And just how acceptable is all this foraging? Are there any restrictions? Here with me now is botanist Sandra Hill from Scottish Natural Heritage, or SNH. Sandra, first of all, is there such a thing as a national policy on mushroom picking?
Hello, James. The nearest thing we have at the moment to a national policy in Scotland is the Code of Conduct published by SNH. It encourages people to follow 9 simple rules of responsible behaviour to protect themselves from poisonous species, but also allow mushrooms and all that thrive in them to flourish undisturbed.
Does mushroom picking do much harm to the environment?
Wildlife needs mushrooms, so you should only pick what you will use. What people often don't realise is that mushrooms and other fungi are fundamental to the existence of trees and plants. The danger is that too many gatherers may trample an area. You see, the main part of the mushroom is below the surface, and trampling collapses the air spaces in the soil and destroys the underground fungal cells.
So, does commercial picking pose a danger?
I'd say it's fine to collect for the family pot, but we're seeing more and more commercial picking, and there may be too many pickers trampling one site. This is frowned upon.
Thank you, Sandra. Well, frowning is one thing, prosecuting someone is another. In the 1990s, the Forestry Commission in England banned commercial picking in the New Forest. This brought it into conflict with Barbara Ray, who runs a small business collecting mushrooms there. It ended up in a court battle. We should have Barbara on the line right now. Hello, Barbara.
Good morning, James.
Can you tell us about this experience?
As far as I'm concerned, mushrooms are public property, and anyone has the right to pick them. I live near the New Forest, and I've been running a small business collecting mushrooms there for 30 years. I sell them to hotels and restaurants.
The Forestry Commission took a different view and prosecuted you for theft, did they not? During the court hearing, they argued that taking products from the forest for commercial gain was like stealing apples from someone's garden.
It was absurd. At least the judge was sensible. He dismissed the case on grounds of pettiness.
So it wasn't seen as a matter for the criminal courts?
Absolutely not. The judge thought it was a waste of time and money. He said he was there to try muggers and drug dealers, not ladies who pick mushrooms.
But shouldn't there be a legal way of challenging commercial pickers if they damage our mushrooms' natural habitat?
Mushrooms actually benefit from careful picking, and commercial pickers usually know what they're doing. When I pick mushrooms, I make sure I don't damage their root system, and I can get a new crop every 10 days for up to 3 months. It's certainly not in my interest to damage the site.
But there have been problems with other commercial pickers who take less care.
Well, when problems arise, it's not from careful mushroom picking by people like me, but from felling trees and damaging the delicate upper layers of the soil where the mushrooms live. Wherever the Forestry Commission has cut down the trees, we won't be seeing the mushrooms again for a long time.
Sandra, a final comment?
It's difficult to say whether there's damage or not. What we are seeing, though, is a massive depletion of the countryside by commercial pickers.
So there we are. Commercial picking may or may not harm the fungus, but no one objects to mushrooms being picked for the kitchen.
Recording 2. Listen to the radio broadcast. Answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 2, before you hear the recording.
Those gold medal pessimists who believe that the prospects of nurturing Olympic talent for London 2012 are already on the slide make care to consider Katie Wong. At just 17, she's a potential Olympic speed skater medalist for the Winter Olympics in Vancouver this year, and she travels widely to compete. Katie has just returned from the European Senior Championships in Latvia, where she helped the British relay squad into the final for the first time. Teams of four change over every lap and a half, with the final skater doing two laps. Katie took over in third, behind Bulgaria and Germany, but passed both. This was Britain's first gold in the event. It was a UK record and the last event of the championships. I caught up with Katie yesterday on her rest day after she arrived home the previous evening.
The Olympics are my dream. It's what you train for. It's why I get out of bed at 5:30 every morning. My coach introduced me to short track at Ayres Centrum Ice Rink 5 years ago. I'd been a figure skater from the age of 8. My coach thought I had more short track potential. When Centrum were short of speed skaters for a match, they asked me to have a go. I couldn't believe my luck when I qualified for the British Championships.
Katie kept on at figure skating until going to Nottingham to skate full time in 2009. She could have gone further in figure skating, but clearly had more potential in short track speed skating.
When the Centrum ice rink closed, there wasn't enough short track ice in Scotland. Although I broke the British record, I was told the lack of ice time would stop me proceeding much further. So I did my standard grades and left for Nottingham at the age of 15. Being away from my family wasn't easy, but I wanted to make skating my career, and Nottingham is where the whole GB squad train. I've been there for 18 months and now I'm studying for A-levels in English and psychology. I hope to go to university. And of course I hope to be an Olympic medal contender this winter.
Katie holds a slew of UK records in various age groups, but she's first to admit the omens were initially inauspicious. The first time she raced abroad, she fell in all three races. But Katie proved a quick learner. I asked her what kind of regime she follows.
Now I'm up at 5:30, 6 days a week. and warmed up by 7:30 for 2 hours on ice. I also train off ice for a further 2 hours, 6 days a week. If I didn't train here in Nottingham, I'd have no support at all. When I qualified for the World Championships and got a medal, it struck me that my opponents would also be at the Olympics, and that I might have a chance there too. You just don't know.
Katie's still growing, so only minimal weight training is allowed, but she doesn't consider her size a problem. She defies critics who suggest that at just 5'2" and under 8 stone, she lacks the strength or physique to be a major force.
It's true that speed skating's pretty physical and there's a lot of pushing, but I'm quite sneaky. Because I'm so small, I can avoid that. It's harder among the boys because they don't think of the consequences. I've had quite a few injuries, ice burns, cuts, stitches and so on. I had a big chunk sliced out of my back last year and my mum was horrified, but you just get on with it.
Here's to a successful Winter Olympics for Katie later this year. Those gold medal pessimists who believe that the prospects of nurturing Olympic talent for London 2012 are already on the slide might care to consider Katie Wong. At just 17, she's a potential Olympic speed skater medalist for the Winter Olympics in Vancouver this year, and she travels widely to compete. Katie has just returned from the European Senior Championships in Latvia, where she helped the British relay squad into the final for the first time. Teams of four change over every lap and a half, with the final skater doing two laps. Katie took over in third, behind Bulgaria and Germany, but passed both. This was Britain's first gold in the event. It was a UK record and the last event of the championships. I caught up with Katie yesterday on her rest day after she arrived home the previous evening.
The Olympics are my dream. It's what you train for. It's why I get out of bed at 5:30 every morning. My coach introduced me to short track at Ayres Centrum Ice Rink 5 years ago. I'd been a figure skater from the age of 8. My coach thought I had more short track potential. When Centrum were short of speed skaters for a match, they asked me to have a go. I couldn't believe my luck when I qualified for the British Championships.
Katie kept on at figure skating until going to Nottingham to skate full time in 2009. She could have gone further in figure skating, but clearly had more potential in short track speed skating.
When the Centrum ice rink closed, there wasn't enough short track ice in Scotland. Although I broke the British record, I was told the lack of ice time would stop me proceeding much further. So I did my standard grades and left for Nottingham at the age of 15. Being away from my family wasn't easy, but I wanted to make skating my career, and Nottingham is where the whole GB squad train. I've been there for 18 months and now I'm studying for A-levels in English and psychology. I hope to go to university. And of course I hope to be an Olympic medal contender this winter.
Katie holds a slew of UK records in various age groups, but she's first to admit the omens were initially inauspicious. The first time she raced abroad, she fell in all three races, but Katie proved a quick learner. I asked her what kind of regime she follows.
Now I'm up at 5:30, 6 days a week, and warmed up by 7:30 for 2 hours on ice. I also train off ice for a further 2 hours, 6 days a week. If I didn't train here in Nottingham, I'd have no support at all. When I qualified for the World Championships and got a medal, it struck me that my opponents would also be at the Olympics, and that I might have a chance there too. You just don't know.
Katie's still growing, so only minimal weight training is allowed, but she doesn't consider her size a problem. She defies critics who suggest that at just 5'2" and under 8 stone, she lacks the strength or physique to be a major force.
It's true that speed skating's pretty physical and there's a lot of pushing, but I'm quite sneaky. Because I'm so small, I can avoid that. It's harder among the boys because they don't think of the consequences. I've had quite a few injuries, ice burns, cuts, stitches and so on. I had a big chunk sliced out of my back last year and my mum was horrified, but you just get on with it.
Here's to a successful Winter Olympics for Katie later this year.
Recording 3. Listen to the report and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 3, before you hear the recording.
The traditional picture of the British family spending its evening slumped in front of the TV has changed dramatically, according to a new report from the watchdog Ofcom. The box is still on, but the people on the sofa are talking on the phone, texting furiously, or surfing the internet. Increasingly, we're using a laptop with a mobile broadband connection while keeping one eye on the TV screen. The report shows the UK's continuing love affair with the mobile. More people send a text every day than access the internet, and there are more phones in circulation than there are people in the UK. The mobile phone and other distractions mean young people are watching fewer TV shows, with 16 to 24-year-olds glued to the set for about 150 minutes a day in 2009, 10 minutes less than 5 years ago, and more than an hour less than the UK average. People over 65, in contrast, spend 5 hours a day watching TV. The 16 to 24 age group is now also spending the most time online. Download and streaming services such as the BBC's iPlayer are reporting record demand, as many choose to watch their favourite TV programmes when they want by getting content from the web. Throwing off the shackles of the TV schedulers is not just the ambition of people with an internet connection. Almost a quarter of UK households had a digital video recorder by the end of last year, up 53% on 2008. DVRs allow people to store their favourite shows for viewing later. Their success is bad news for advertisers, who use commercial television to get in front of a mass audience. Of those with a digital recorder, 88% always skip past the ads, according to Ofcom. The Ofcom report shows that online advertising hit £2.8 billion last year, up 40%, and eclipsing spending on the traditional terrestrial channels such as ITV and Channel 4 for the first time. Given how much more time people spend watching TV than using the internet, the figures look incongruous. But the Ofcom report does not take into account the amount of time British consumers spend online at work. Most households that have a computer are already online, with PC penetration running at 72% in the UK and internet penetration close behind at 67%. Broadband take-up of UK households has slowed, not least because younger consumers, such as students, are opting to buy mobile phone dongles that give internet access and are often cheaper than a lengthy broadband contract. Over 2 million Britons now use mobile internet services, with sales of dongles nearly doubling between February and June 2008. The report also found that though most people say they care about the environment, we don't seem to consider the impact when buying a TV. Two-thirds of us claim that we turn off our devices to save energy, and one of the interesting things about the media communications sector is that there isn't the same level of awareness or understanding of environmental issues that you have in markets like white goods or motor vehicles. So, for instance, we found that many people, in fact more than half of us, decide to leave our set-top boxes on standby when not in use. If everyone in this country with a set-top box left it on at night, it would use the same amount of electricity to make 80 billion cups of tea. Ofcom's remit is not to wag fingers at people or companies in terms of the environmental impact of what they're doing, but it's to promote better understanding and appreciation of these issues. Manufacturers, for their part, are expected to communicate these issues either at point of sale or in the promotional materials when they're selling these devices. The traditional picture of the British family spending its evening slumped in front of the TV has changed dramatically, according to a new report from the watchdog Ofcom. The box is still on, but the people on the sofa are talking on the phone, texting furiously, or surfing the internet. Increasingly, we're using a laptop with a mobile broadband connection while keeping one eye on the TV screen. The report shows the UK's continuing love affair with the mobile. More people send a text every day than access the internet, and there are more phones in circulation than there are people in the UK. The mobile phone and other distractions mean young people are watching fewer TV shows, with 16 to 24-year-olds glued to the set for about 150 minutes a day in 2009, 10 minutes less than 5 years ago, and more than an hour less than the UK average. People over 65, in contrast, spend 5 hours a day watching TV. The 16 to 24 age group is now also spending the most time online. Download and streaming services such as the BBC's iPlayer are reporting record demand, as many choose to watch their favourite TV programmes when they want by getting content from the web. Throwing off the shackles of the TV schedulers is not just the ambition of people with an internet connection. Almost a quarter of UK households had a digital video recorder by the end of last year, up 53% on 2008. DVRs allow people to store their favourite shows for viewing later. Their success is bad news for advertisers, who use commercial television to get in front of a mass audience. Of those with a digital recorder, 88% always skip past the ads, according to Ofcom. The Ofcom report shows that online advertising hit £2.8 billion last year, up 40%, and eclipsing spending on the traditional terrestrial channels such as ITV and Channel 4 for the first time. Given how much more time people spend watching TV than using the internet, the figures look incongruous. But the Ofcom report does not take into account the amount of time British consumers spend online at work. Most households that have a computer are already online, with PC penetration running at 72% in the UK and internet penetration close behind at 67%. Broadband take-up of UK households has slowed, not least because younger consumers, such as students, are opting to buy mobile phone dongles that give internet access and are often cheaper than a lengthy broadband contract. Over 2 million Britons now use mobile internet services, with sales of dongles nearly doubling between February and June 2008. The report also found that though most people say they care about the environment, we don't seem to consider the impact when buying a TV. Two-thirds of us claim that we turn off our devices to save energy, and one of the interesting things about the media communications sector is that there isn't the same level of awareness or understanding of environmental issues that you have in markets like white goods or motor vehicles. So, for instance, we found that many people, in fact more than half of us, decide to leave our set-top boxes on standby when not in use. If everyone in this country with a set-top box left it on at night, it would use the same amount of electricity to make 80 billion cups of tea. Ofcom's remit is not to wag fingers at people or companies in terms of the environmental impact of what they're doing, but it's to promote better understanding and appreciation of these issues. Manufacturers, for their part, are expected to communicate these issues either at point of sale or in the promotional materials when they're selling these devices.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.